Proceed with Merritt versus R&amp;R Capital.
Morning, Your Honor. I rise to make some quick introductions. My name is Rich Rallo on behalf of the appellees. At the council table is my co-counsel, Paul Sweeney of Sertleman Balin in New York, and the other appellee, the court-appointed receiver, Kurt Heyman.
Welcome to the court.
Good morning. Eric Grandel. I'd like to present to the court Thomas D. Snyder, who's PROHAC BJ here today on behalf of the appellant.
Welcome, Mr. Snyder. Are you ready to proceed?
I am.
When I start the clock, you'll see a green light, and it'll switch to yellow when you get to the 5 minutes you've reserved. You can continue talking when the light's yellow, but you'll be using up your reserve time.
I understand, Your Honor. Thank you. This is the case of R&R Capital versus Lynn Merritt. This case has a very convoluted procedural history, so convoluted, Your Honors, that Chancellor Chandler called this something like the most convoluted case he's ever been involved in. And yet we have a situation where Ms. Merritt, who was here today, was deprived of her right to counsel right from the get-go, despite an indemnification agreement in the operating agreements of the partnerships for which she was managing member. This case began in New York, it migrated to Pennsylvania, and then it migrated here. And the end result of all that was that Ms. Merritt, who was the managing member of a series of partnerships, was divested, we say unfairly, of her position as managing member of the partnership entities. There are a series of partnership entities that are involved. They all had the same operating agreement or extremely similar. The differences in the operating agreements are of no moment for this appeal. But each operating agreement made her the managing member. Each operating agreement had an indemnification provision in Section 9.1 of the operating agreements. And each provision had the same for-cause removal provision in Sections 4.4 and 4.5. And so basically the landscape is the same for each operating agreement. I just wanted to make that clear from the outset. There are four issues that we raised in this appeal. Before I get to them, bottom line is, Ms. Merritt was removed as managing member by Chancellor Chandler, and then to exacerbate matters, she was held in contempt without a hearing, without affidavits, without sworn testimony, and imposed and sanctions were imposed upon her grossly excessive to what the alleged contempt was. The contempt in question was at most in the area of $150,000. She submitted evidence that there was $15 million of assets. Nevertheless, the chancellor divested her of all of her assets for her alleged contempt, even though the amount in controversy was far shorter, far smaller. So with that, that's why we're here today. We took an appeal from the chancellor's series of decisions, which are all in our brief, and we're here on four issues. Issue number one, the indemnification agreement, Section 9.1, gave Ms. Merritt the right to indemnification and for attorney's fees. She had a right to counsel as managing member under these agreements. Chancellor Chandler refused, despite Delaware law to the contrary, to allow her advancements for counsel. Basically, it's akin to sending a baseball batter up to the plate without a bat. Because in this type of proceeding, which the chancellor himself called extraordinarily convoluted, Ms. Merritt needed counsel to defend herself against the allegations that R&R raised against her. She had to have that in order to...
Now, with regard to the advancements, can you tell us the specific date of that ruling? There's a debate in the briefs about whether there was really a request to sell assets for the purpose of paying advancements or whether there was a request for advancement. But if we're going to reverse a specific ruling denying a request for advancement, tell me the date and the appendix page where I can find it.
Well, there were two rulings, Your Honor. One was in June, shortly after the case, the complaint was filed by R&R. There was a status hearing in front of Judge Chancellor Chandler. And I believe the date of that status quo order is, I'm turning to the brief, I believe it is September the 8th of 2008 was the status quo order. That was the first order. There were two occasions on which there was...
Where is that in the appendix?
I'm not sure of the appendix site. I do know that it is attached to the brief at tab 1. Tab 1 of the opening brief, I believe, is the order relating to the status quo in which there was a denial. And I believe that in the brief also...
Wait a second. Let's slow down here. I'm looking at the first status quo order, which is tab 1. Can you show me where in this it denies advancement?
I don't see any specific reference to the advancement, Your Honors. I can, if I have a...
Should we forget about this one?
No, Your Honors, please don't. One second, I will turn to the... Let me go to the procedural history, and I will identify where it's mentioned. Well, I don't see that site, but I can get you the next site for the second occasion in which it was raised.
All right.
The second occasion on which it was raised was in July of 2009, and there the site to the appendix is a modification of the tab 6 has the oral argument relating to the hearing in which Ms. Merritt asked for a modification of the status quo order in order to award her advancement of counsel fees. That's at tab 6 of the opening brief. And in tab 6, Judge Chancellor Chandler said that he's not going to, my view is that no one should be advanced any fees in this litigation, neither Ms. Merritt nor any of the plaintiffs who have brought the actions, until the court is able to resolve finally the rights and liabilities and responsibilities of the various parties involved. That's at tab 6 of the opening brief. So I apologize for not, I can provide you the site later if the court will allow me to submit the, to by way of a supplemental filing, the site to the record for the opening status quo order. But this is the second stat, this was a modification of the status quo hearing in which the issue was raised for a second time, and Chancellor Chandler said no. And so I believe that order and the first order are the two orders that are subject to this appeal for Section 9.1, Your Honor, to answer your question. So with that, I'm going to proceed. 9.1 provides, like in many other cases that this court has held and the lower courts in Delaware have held, that an indemnification provision is supposed to apply immediately. It's not supposed to be a wait-and-see kind of situation in which the court decides at the end of the case whether to award counsel or whether to advance counsel fees or not. It has to happen up front, especially in a situation like this. Because without counsel, Ms. Merritt had absolutely, she was left on her own to battle against well-heeled opposing parties with sophisticated lawyers representing them. That, in effect, gave her almost was impossible to for her to combat. And it not only was it impossible to combat on the merits, but later on in the case, when the chancellor held Ms. Merritt in contempt, refusing to hold any evidentiary hearings, refusing to acknowledge to award her an accounting in which she could present the valuation of the assets that were being taken from her. An attorney at that point would have done, a remarkable amount of good in order to advance her cause. She didn't have that. She was left without counsel. If this were a criminal case, it would be obviously reversible error. This is the next worst thing. This is a situation in which we have an attorney not present while a pro se plaintiff is forced to operate in her own, and what's more, the chancellor chastised her for not having counsel. The chancellor said, I've given you, I've been lenient with you, I've given you opportunities, why haven't you gotten counsel? After he deprived her of it in the first place. I submit that in itself requires a reversal of a vocatur of the orders in this case to allow for counsel to represent her against all the allegations made by R&R.
Are we to understand that your client was unable to retain counsel without an advancement of fees?
That's correct, Your Honor. She was not. She had no funds. She was bereft. And as a result, she had to, eventually this case resulted in her bankruptcy. She received a relief from the stay of her bankruptcy proceedings in order for to raise this appeal. That's why I'm here on her behalf. I'm representing her pro bono, and so that's the situation. We submit that that in itself requires an undoing of all the orders that Judge Chancellor Chandler entered. The next issue I'd like to address is an issue of res judicata arising from the proceedings in this case. I mentioned a few moments ago that there were proceedings in New York in which this is where R&R first filed their action against Ms. Merritt. They were unsatisfied with those series of decisions by Justice Ramos of the New York Supreme Court. And as a result, they came first to Pennsylvania and then here. They say here, when they filed their 2008 declaratory judgment action, they say, and I want to point this out to the court, in their appendix, at appendix B-425, they say, they came to Delaware to seek Ms. Merritt's removal as managing member. They said, we're not proceeding on any basis that was raised in the New York proceedings. The New York proceedings had begun years earlier in 2005. They began the proceedings here in Delaware in 2008, 3 years later. They say in a footnote, R&R previously sought the removal of Merritt in a complaint filed in 2005 in New York, based entirely on conduct by Merritt occurring prior to November of 2005. That claim was dismissed by the New York court in October of 2006. None of the allegations set forth in this action were present in the New York action. They came here and they said to Chancellor Chandler, we're coming here based on entirely new misconduct. We don't have anything to say about the alleged misconduct that we raised in New York. I submit to the court that that is inaccurate, extraordinarily inaccurate. They, in New York, I have cites to it if I can refer the court to pages 9 and 10 of the reply brief that we filed, which in turn cite to the appendix, which demonstrate that they came here and they eventually secured Ms. Merritt's removal as managing member based upon fraud that they alleged in the New York proceedings. I repeat, after coming here and saying they weren't proceeding on the basis of fraud in New York, they turn around and in 2009, they say that an order entered in another federal proceeding in federal court in Pennsylvania was fraud, but that fraud was based upon alleged fraud that they had raised in New York in 2005. They changed positions in midstream after assuring Chancellor Chandler that they did not attempt to or were not attempting to secure Ms. Merritt's removal on the basis of 2005 misconduct. That's exactly what they wound up doing. I submit that was barred by res judicata because A, they raised that in New York. B, in October of 2006, the New York court, and again, this is cited to in our reply brief on pages 9 and 10 and also in our opening brief. The New York court dismissed those counts of removal. They said, you can't remove her. And that was a dead issue until they revived it and came here and said, you know what, she should be removed. And we submit that res judicata bars that. There's the case of LaPointe. LaPointe is this court's decision, which addresses situations like that. Specifically, a basic textbook case of res judicata. When causes of action can be raised or are raised in an underlying, in the first proceeding, then they can't be raised again in a second proceeding, especially after they've been decided in the first proceeding. That's what happened here. A sister state decided these issues. They shouldn't be raised again.
I thought there was a holding by Judge McLaughlin that the New York court's ruling concerned only the parties jointly owned racehorses and did not concern the three pinhooking horses at issue in this case.
Well, at first, Your Honor, Judge McLaughlin made a decision that this did not concern fraud from the New York proceeding. But then she wound up saying that there was fraud. And that's what they used, R&R used, to secure Ms. Merritt's removal. They said that Judge McLaughlin reached a decision in 2009 and that that was the grounds for which Ms. Merritt should be removed as managing member. After they had said, but that finding in 2009 is important to emphasize, Your Honor. That holding by Judge McLaughlin in 2009 was based on conduct raised in the New York complaint in 2005. There's simply no doubt about it.
Well, and what about this quote that I just read to you? Judge McLaughlin, quote, said, the court found that the December 10, 2007 ruling of the New York court concerned only the parties jointly owned racehorses and did not concern the three pin-hooking horses at issue in this case.
Well, she I think got it wrong, but if you look at the pleadings themselves identify a cause of action relating to the pin-hooking horses. In the New York pleadings, R&R raised that very issue. And what's more, in October of 2006, R&R sought Ms. Merritt's removal on the basis of the pin-hooking fraud, and Justice Ramos denied it. So my point is, Your Honor, it was raised in the New York pleadings. It was then ruled upon by Justice Ramos. And so what?
On the merits?
On the merits, on October 10th of 2006. Justice Ramos said, is there, these issues are dismissed. I'm paraphrasing. And there was no further debate on that issue.
Dismissed with prejudice?
That's the implication. I think he said dismissed. There was a removal issue that he ruled upon on October 10th of 2006, and that was the end of the matter until it was revived by R&R and brought to other courts.
What's the New York rule when a judge says something and does not say it's with prejudice or without prejudice? Is there a presumptive rule that it's without prejudice?
I don't know that answer, Your Honor. I don't know if it's presumptive or not. I don't know if it matters. I think it does. I think there was no further dispute on that. I think the implication was that's off the table. In fact, those were the very words. That's off the table. That's what Justice Ramos and the lawyers, those words were spoken on October 10th. That's off the table. So I don't know if there needed to be a written order, if that's what Your Honor is asking. But I would submit that that was treated as such or should have been treated as such, but wasn't.
You only have 2.5 minutes left. Would you like to reserve that, or do you have another argument you want to raise now?
I will reserve my time. I'd like to discuss the contempt issue on rebuttal if necessary. If I've done with 17.5 minutes, I think I reserve the rest of my time.
Well, in fairness to your opponent, you should say what you're going to say about contempt.
The contempt is, I'll summarize very quickly. There was no hearing. There should have been a hearing. There were no hearings. There was no testimony. There were no sworn affidavits. And the sanctions in question were grossly excessive in comparison to what the alleged contempt was. Ms. Merritt submitted evidence that it was her assets were worth $15 million. Justice Chandler did not even hold an accounting and could have done so, and that was as a result of Ms. Merritt being denied counsel. I think that's the principal reason why they were able to, or aren't always able to do that. So with that, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Again, for the record, this is Rich Rollo on behalf of appellees R&R and FTP. Perhaps it's most efficient if I start with one or two questions raised by the panel. First, my friend repeatedly says Ms. Merritt was pro se. A-1781 is a transcript in which Merritt and Chancellor Chandler walk through all of the lawyers that have represented Merritt. Merritt was represented by counsel in this exact action until July 2009. After the ruling, she retained counsel in Pennsylvania in connection with a bankruptcy filing. and she's retained counsel in connection with this action. Now, to suggest she is pro se, I believe the end of the transcript at the final hearing, Ms. Merritt repeatedly made that statement to Chancellor Chandler, and he in words or substance said he didn't believe her. Again, A-1781 is the transcript. As for Your Honor's question concerning what was appealed in this action, it is on opening brief, page 14. They did not appeal the original status quo order. As you're, during the first 20 minutes, I looked through the appendix as best as I could, and I couldn't locate it. There are motions to amend, four or five of them. And ultimately, the only cite in their opening brief as to the order that is being appealed is appendix 193 to 194. That is the request to modify the pre-existing status quo order in July 2009. That is the order that's fairly before this court for appeal, not the initial argument. Now, I'll get to the circumstances surrounding the initial argument in a moment. And for sense of efficiency, I'll tick through the arguments that they have appealed in order just to make it a little easier.
All right. Well, I don't want to complicate this, but I do want to tell you, as a general rule of appellate procedure, if you have a final judgment and your notice of appeal is from the final judgment, you can bring up prior interlocutory rulings, which would have included this original order. The question then becomes, have you fully and fairly briefed and argued that issue in your opening brief? And our lead case on that is Roca versus DuPont. So I don't want you to be lulled into some sense that by not referring to it, they can't raise the issue. The question is, did they fully and fairly raise the denial of advancement in their opening brief?
Understood, Your Honor, and I'll address both the order that they challenged and also the underlying merits the best I can. But let's focus on the status quo ruling in 2009. With regard to argument one that's in their brief, the trial court's denial of a request to modify the status quo order was not an abuse of discretion. Now, Merritt's opening brief, we believe, misstates the issue on appeal and also the relevant standard of review. The trial court did not decide the substantive question of advancement. The ruling that they cite to, the court acknowledges that there is some uncertainty with respect to advancement. So rather than ruling on the underlying substantive question, he simply refused to modify the status quo order, which was pre-existing. And we submit in our case cites that the standard for that is abuse of discretion. Now, we raised that in our... Yes, ma'am.
Wait a second. I'm sorry to be asking all these questions, but you will have to agree that this is an unusual case in terms of the number of rulings and comments and what have you that are supposedly on appeal here. But on page 9 of tab 6, which is the transcript of the July 10 hearing, the court says, all right, well then, let me address that. My view is that no one should be advanced any fees in this litigation, neither Mr. Merritt nor any of the plaintiffs who have brought the actions, until the court is able to resolve finally the rights and liabilities and responsibilities of the various parties involved in these entities. Isn't that a ruling on advancement?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and let me put those comments in context.
Okay.
That is July 2009. Prior to that, the case in Delaware had been stayed. Ms. Merritt, in one of her non-Delaware proceedings after the status quo order was entered, went to New York and obtained an injunction. And that injunction said withdraw in Delaware. It was ultimately stayed and overturned. But in the interim, while that injunction was out there, Chancellor Chandler said, I will not go forward substantively in Delaware in light of the injunction. The question of advancement is a substantive determination because we disputed it. In a letter, and given the fact that this issue, I can point to you in the record in a moment where we raised the issue, but functionally we contested whether or not she had a right to advancement after removal. Our position at the time was, one, the contractual advancement right in Section 9.1 was terminated as of August 20th, 2008. And that is pursuant to provision for Section 4.5. Section 4.5, in words or substance, says if you are removed for cause, you are immediately terminated, and all rights under this document are gone, except for your right to receive payment under 4.5. Now, that is a reference in 4.5 to a repurchase of the member's membership interest.
Did Chancellor Chandler ever address Section 4.5?
Section 4.5 was the removal provision. So in the context of the argument under 4.5A that fraud had occurred, that earlier portion he addressed, and that was the subject of count one in the motion for summary judgment. But this portion was never addressed, but it was teed up to the court in, I think it's footnote 35 to a letter on January 30th, 2009, in which we opposed an earlier motion to modify the status quo order.
Well,
and I'm sorry, yes, Your Honor.
I ask that is because if we look at the section Justice Berger read, mm-hmm. and where the court says we're going to deal with advancement after we sort out the merits, that's somewhat inconsistent with our holdings on advancement because the argument by the person seeking advancement is, in order for me to properly develop the merits, I need advancement to get an attorney. So is there another reason for denying advancement as opposed to postponing it? And that's why I asked my question here, because if the chancellor had simply said, look, you're removed under the agreement, you no longer are entitled to advancement denied, that would be one thing for us to consider on appeal. But the only thing we've seen so far is a ruling that says I'm going to decide advancement later.
And let me address that directly, Your Honor. Section 4.5 says we delivered a demand, and the demand says you're removed for cause, and here are the reasons. 4.5 says that in that instance, the manager shall be deemed removed on the date of delivery of written demand, which in this case was August 20th, 2008. We then came to Delaware and said, confirm the validity of the removal. In that context, and go on in 4.5, such removal shall immediately terminate all managers' rights and privileges hereunder. Our position...
Can I interrupt you
ma'am.
Second? Because I'm more interested in hearing an answer to Justice Collins' question, which is, other than that section I just read to you from the transcript, is there any other ruling from the court on whether there will be advancement or not?
That is the only, to my knowledge, ruling where he substantively declined to modify the status quo order. There were earlier rulings in which Merritt requested a modification of the status quo order, and he refused to modify based on the existence of the stay.
We're looking for rulings that include the word advancement.
No, Your Honor, that's the only one then.
So
to my knowledge, and to be clear, prior to this ruling, when the action was stayed, Merritt made multiple requests for advancement. And the court said, I will not consider that request because this action is stayed, and therefore I won't receive the substantive question. The only advancement argument that I'm aware of where he decided it directly is the ruling that Your Honor read from.
So isn't that what we should be dealing with in terms of whether as a matter of law or contract it was appropriate to deny advancement?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, which is the position we take in our brief. It's the ruling in July 2009 that is relevant, and that is the request not to confirm that she had advancement or confirm that we had advancement because we claimed it as well as managers, but whether or not he could permissively modify the existing status quo order, and we submit that that's an abuse of discretion standard. Now, prior to that, there was a request for advancement when this action was initially filed. And we have a waiver argument in our brief just to tell Your Honors where I'm pointing to. The initial hearing, counsel for Merritt stood up and said, well, it's telephonic, that there should be a carve-out for advancement. Point blank. It's in the transcript.
And where is that in the appendix?
That is B-457 and 458. Your Honor couldn't, Chancellor Chandler could not resolve the question in the hearing. He said, brief it. Come back to me. They dropped the argument. They did not press the argument in their brief on status quo. We then put our reply in, and ultimately the status quo order was entered. We submit that's a waiver. A year later, they come back and make the same argument again that they had abandoned previously. So
are you saying that the court was denying advancement because the request had been waived?
I'm submitting that at the initial hearing before Chandler, when the question of the status quo order was raised initially, my friends
right.
took the position.
Right. We've agreed now that the only place where the court made a ruling with respect to advancement is on page 9 of tab 6, where
yes,
he said he's not going to allow advancement for either side until he's resolved on the merits.
Yes, ma'am.
Either that was a ruling that is supportable or it wasn't. And waiver doesn't seem to have anything to do with that.
Well, the reason why I believe waiver might be relevant is that when they originally take that position in front of Chandler and then choose to withdraw it, and they don't press the argument against the motion for status quo, we submit that that constitutes a waiver of the argument that there should be a carve-out in the status quo order for advancement. And so subsequently, when they make their pitch about advancement to revisit an issue that they originally raised and then abandoned, that under waiver, they weren't entitled to make the argument that an advancement should be a carve-out.
So what you're saying is we should ignore the court's ruling on September 9th because the court shouldn't have even addressed it.
I wouldn't submit that we should ignore the ruling because his ruling was, I believe, on a different basis. I submit that for purposes of an appeal where they had previously waived the argument that there should be no overturning here or error here because the argument they were making in July had previously been waived based on their conduct earlier.
Was that a ruling of the Chancellor?
No, Your Honor, it was not. What the Chancellor, because 4.5 ties your indemnification right, or pardon me, your advancement right to your status as a manager, and there was a dispute as between whether R&R or Merritt was the manager, Chancellor Chandler did what I think is the most reasonable step is, until I figure out if you're a manager and you have this right, I'm not going to give anybody advancement. Now, there is a case on point, and we cite it in our papers, then Vice Chancellor Stein, that addresses this scenario. And I'd like to draw one big distinction. This is the LLC context, and we submit that unlike the corporate context, where you have all of the public policy about advancement, the overriding policy here is freedom of contract. The parties could have drafted this however they want. And in fact, this contract says Ms. Meredith, the manager, had virtually every single protection you could imagine. No fiduciary duties, unilateral control. There was one safeguard, her removal for cause. And 4.5 says if we decide, as the money, we put in $9 million, if we decide that she's no longer trustworthy because she committed fraud, we can terminate her for cause. And we did that. That was our safeguard. And the contract in 4.5 says if we do that, all of her rights, except for the right to get repurchased on her membership interest, all of them are terminated.
We understand that argument. The difficulty we're having is that it doesn't appear to be the basis for the court's ruling. If the court had said exactly what you just said, it would be a much clearer issue. But what the court said, and based on what you've told us, is simply, I'm going to postpone the issue for a later day.
I agree with that, Your Honor, although in the context of where we have taken the position with the court that the advancement right is contingent before the ruling, the court has our summary judgment brief that has the fraud finding at this point in time. He has the fraud finding in Pennsylvania. He has the summary judgment brief that says she should remove for cause, which would then put us in that context, he knows the dispute. So when he says in the transcript, I submit, that until I find out the status functionally vis-a-vis the LLCs, it is a reference to whether or not you are a manager. If she was a manager, she has rights. If she was removed on August 20, 2008, she doesn't have any contractual claim to advancement or indemnification at that time.
Isn't it frequently the case that when we are dealing with questions of indemnification and advancement, one side is saying you're not entitled to it because of A, B, C, D, or E. But you're litigating that point, and while you're litigating it, you get advancement. Isn't that generally the rule?
That is generally the case, and
why
I would say
doesn't it apply here?
And I would say why it does not apply here is that all of the cases I believe Your Honor is referring to are primarily in the corporate context. Here, this is an LLC. We cite a case in our brief. It's Gary versus Beezer Homes. It's tab 9 in our compendium. It's a case by then Vice Chancellor Stein. And it's almost on all fours. In that scenario, the individual had an employment agreement that had a disputed advancement right. And the provision said, if you are fired for cause, you lose all rights here under except for certain payments. Same scenario we have here. And in that context, then Vice Chancellor Stein said, you don't get advancement.
Was this argument made before the Court of Chancery?
This case was not addressed before Chancellor Chandler. The hearing at issue where Chandler said he denied the motion to compel, Merritt was represented by counsel Brian Farnan, and at that point in time, after the hearing, he withdrew.
I'm referring to the argument under 4.5. Was that made to the Court of Chancery?
During the hearing, it was not. The last argument, there were, I think, three motions where she moved to modify the status quo order. We had submitted those previously, and in every iteration after, our response was, this action stayed. Unless Your Honor asks us, we won't put in an additional paper. So the last piece of paper that Chandler had on this point from us, my understanding substantively, was a January 30th, 2009 argument, and the argument was made on 4.9, and it's footnote 35. It's in my outline, and I can provide the exact reference. It is in our appendix. But footnote 35 has this argument. It says, under 4.5, she loses all rights as of that date. And so until Your Honor determines her status.
I don't want to belabor this. I just want to make sure you say whatever you want to in response. If we were reviewing a crisp ruling under 4.5, this would be a much different case. We're not reviewing that. So tell us why, under that the Chancellor's ruling that we do have in front of us was correct when he said, I'm going to decide this later.
Your Honor, I think our analysis of the issue is what I've laid out in 4.5, but let me give Your Honor a different reason. Even if it was erroneous, it's harmless error. Before the courts right now is the summary judgment on count one. That's the removal by merit. It is de novo. She is represented by counsel. If Your Honors conclude that count one is right, then the error by Chandler, to the extent there was one, was not outcome determinative. It didn't result in an erroneous conclusion because she was removed, and all of her rights as of August 2008 were gone. So even if Your Honors conclude that it was erroneous for him to make that determination, it didn't result in a different outcome. Therefore, we submit it's not reversible error.
And you're saying that's because she was represented throughout the proceeding?
No, Your Honor, because in this proceeding, the count one, which is the confirmation of her removal as a manager, is being reviewed de novo.
Well,
as a question of law.
Was she represented with regard to the hearing that led to her removal?
The summary judgment briefing, her counsel in Delaware had removed, and Chancellor Chandler, and we contended at the time that in other jurisdictions, in New York and Pennsylvania, she had counsel. One of them.
Did she have Delaware counsel to argue the merits that she should not be removed?
Delaware counsel had withdrawn. There was a counsel, Joe Faravani, who had been admitted pro hoc vice, and there is a discussion during the hearing in which the court was unclear with respect to whether or not Mr. Faravanti was going to continue as her counsel. He did not show up on the papers. He did not argue on her behalf, and this was decided without argument on the papers.
You can see where this would be a difficult argument in a criminal case by analogy to say the defendant didn't have an attorney, the jury convicted him, and the fact that he was denied his constitutional right to counsel really doesn't matter anyway because he was convicted and he's guilty. And the defendant would say, well, you know, maybe if I had an attorney, I wouldn't have been convicted.
And I think where this is different, Your Honor, is an issue before Your Honors, de novo, right now, is what does 4.5 mean? Did we have cause and was she validly removed? We submit it's clear as day. And if there is only one reasonable reading of that contract, and there are no disputes of fact with respect to that, and Your Honors confirm, yes, she committed fraud. That falls within 4.5A, therefore she is validly terminated. Whether you had 20 lawyers or no lawyers, Your Honors would reach that same conclusion because it's the only conclusion. Therefore, unlike the criminal scenario where the underlying issues aren't being revisited anew and fresh, if Your Honors confirm the validity of that removal, it's there. I have 11 seconds.
Determination in the first instance.
Yes, Your Honor. I have 5 seconds left on the contempt. It's clear as day in the papers. Ms. Merritt knew what was happening. She was explained, it was explained to her that she had violated. I see I've run out of time. May I briefly address the contempt point?
No.
Or I'm happy to sit, Your Honor.
Well, rely on what you wrote in your brief.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I don't think I need all of my rebuttal time. I just have one brief comment, Your Honor. I think that my friend here did not address the very important issue of res judicata, and I think that precluded any removal under 4.4 and 4.5 of the operating agreements. And I pointed out a few minutes ago, and I'll point out again, that this issue was presented in New York pleadings. This issue was litigated in New York. There was an October 10, 2006 determination by Justice Ramos that there should not have, that removal was off the table. I don't think they can come to Delaware after that and file an action purportedly on the basis of 2008 conduct, but which in reality they turn into removal based on pre-2008 conduct, because
so
that's...
I assume the point you're trying to make here is if there had been advancement and she did have an attorney, the attorney would have made the res judicata argument.
Correct, Your Honor. Thank you. I have nothing further. If Your Honors have any questions for me.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, might I have permission? I was asked a question. I believe I made a misstatement. I want to just correct it.
Yes.
Your Honor asked if there were any other rulings by Chancellor Chandler with respect to advancement. On April 13th, 2010, Chancellor Chandler denied a modification of the status quo order. Defendant merits April 6, 2010 letter seeking advancement of legal fees and other relief is denied. This was shortly after a ruling by Justice Ramos that was ultimately overturned. I believe there was a writ of mandamus around this time to this court related to this issue, but that was another ruling directly on advancement. The copy I have in my hand, it does not have the stamp on it. I can find the record citation, but it is in the record. I'm confident of that.
Your Honor, it was attached to appellant's brief.
But I'll find the record.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you all for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess. Thank you.